support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. I like the Nets and Knicks, you know? The Knicks against the Nets. It's so New York, New Jersey, hence if not good as it gets, still good enough for guys like me from there or thereabouts, although the series is a setup for some likely routes. We'll probably see much closer games occurring in L.A. and Houston when the Lakers and the Rockets get to play, which they will do tonight, as will the Pacers and the Celts, who slipped into the playoffs for the lack of someone else. In other action, Memphis has decamped to San Antone. Tomorrow it's the Mavs and Kings. I bet the Mavs could phone in their performance and still win. Detroit might do the same. They play the Bucks, who at 500 are just north of lame. In summary, that time of year that hoop fans view as sweet is here, and no one's happier than folks who love the Heat. I'm referring here to the Miami Heat, a team that finished 25-57 last year and seemed destined to be just as bad this season. Former head coach Pat Riley resigned 3 days before the regular season began, and the Heat started the season 0-7 on the way to losing 15 of 20. But Miami has turned out to be the surprise of the NBA season, ultimately charging to a fourth-place finish in the East. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports.
3 days before the Miami Heat's regular season began, Heat president and former head coach Pat Riley announced the head coaching job would go to Stan Van Gundy, who had served as Riley's assistant for 8 years. Van Gundy enjoyed Monday's 84-77 victory over the Boston Celtics and even took time to chide the media about low expectations.
It feels great to know that we can't finish below 500. Even you guys, I think, would have at 5-15 not given us any hope of that, though some of you will claim that you did.
Center Brian Grant gives his coach a lot of credit for saving the team from implosion.
Stan was able to withstand an 0-7 start and keep us motivated throughout that and see the potential in the team and make us see the potential in ourselves until it started to turn around.
It may be easy to point to Van Gundy as the biggest reason for that turnaround, but Miami Herald columnist Dan Lebatard thinks that's wrong.
It's a nice story to give a lot of credit to the little frumpy coach who's always disheveled, but I think the whole thing is overstated. They've just got better players, and it doesn't matter how much genius you have on the sidelines. You better have some guys who can jump.
Guard Eddie Jones, a former All-Star and the team's leading scorer, agrees.
Nothing against the guys that we had last year, but we didn't have an abundance of talent. I think this year we got abundance of talent. We got a lot of youth. We got a lot of mixture of youth and veterans. I think that's the key. When you got youth and veterans and guys have been in the league maybe 3-4 years, I think that's a good team. You know, I mean, you got something to build around. You know, talent is everything in this league. If you don't have it, you don't win.
Two new Miami talents, forward Lamar Odom and guard Dwayne Wade, have helped the Heat win this season. Odom, who signed with the Heat last summer, twice violated the NBA's drug policy in 2001. But now Odom has become the player everyone expected him to be after he was chosen fourth in the 1999 NBA draft. He was the Eastern Conference Player of the Month in March, averaging almost 18 points and 11 rebounds a game. Since coming off the disabled list in late January, rookie Wade has become the team's third highest scorer. With these two players coming on at the right time, perhaps it's not a shock the Heat are in the playoffs after all. Eddie Jones says they aren't surprised.
We never stop working. That's one thing I'll say about this team, is we have a lot of character in this locker room. We knew if we got all our bodies back healthy, the guys that we didn't have at the beginning of the year, we knew we could do some good things. We know how good this team could have been.
The Heat will get another chance to prove how good they are when they host the New Orleans Hornets in the opener of their first-round playoff series tomorrow night. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
If you're inclined to turn on your TV about an hour before today's first NBA playoff game begins, you can witness the WNBA draft on ESPN, a television first for the Women's Pro League. If you do tune in, don't expect mystery and suspense, at least in terms of the first pick. I'm joined now by Clay Callum, editor of Full Court Press, for discussion of the draft and other WNBA-related matters. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Well, thank you. So, Diana Taurasi gets picked first. She saves the WNBA, just like Sue Bird did before her and Lauren Jackson and Shamiqua Holtzclaw. Should I go on?
Well, you could, except actually none of them has quite saved the WNBA.
Well, my point precisely. Does it happen this time? Or, you know, is the WNBA in the practice of putting too much emphasis on the first pick in the draft every year?
Well, I think that's partially what happens in almost every professional sport. This year, though, Diana Taurasi is a very, very special player, and not just because of what she can do on the court. Not only is she a great shooter and a dazzling offensive player capable of creativity you don't see often in the women's game, she is charismatic, excitable, one of those people you have to react to. In women's basketball, you love Diana or you hate Diana, but no one's indifferent.
Well, at least one sports writer in Phoenix has admitted that he's never seen a WNBA game. He can't name four teams in the league, but he will be there to watch Diana Taurasi play, and he'll be thoroughly impressed, I'm sure.
Well, perhaps. People forget just how tough the WNBA is. That's one of the problems with hyping the college player to come in and save the league. The league's a lot better than that. It's like expecting LeBron James to come in and be better than Kevin Garnett. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen.
Well, who are the other players who will be coming into the league via this draft that we should be especially excited by?
Well, it's a very, very deep draft, really the best collegiate draft in WNBA history. Elena Beard of Duke may be Diana Taurasi's foil for years to come. Mm-hmm. They'll guard each other. Beard is a great defensive player, also has a lot of offensive skills, but doesn't have the charisma of Taurasi. Nicole Powell is a very tall player for women's basketball at 6'2". She's like a Kevin Garnett in many ways. She can score, she can pass, she can rebound. She does a lot of different things. Lindsey Whalen had a great NCAA tournament. She's a very fun player to watch, very emotional and exciting. Shamika Christen, people haven't heard of, but she's a great athlete. There's post players. There's a lot of people in this draft who are very, very interesting and could really have an impact on the league for years to come.
Clay, you mentioned Lindsey Whalen. Minnesota would very much like to keep her at home, but they'd have to trade way up in the draft to make that happen. Not bad, the amount of attention for the first former Gopher ever to be considered in the WNBA draft.
Oh, absolutely. She's really come out of nowhere to just place her mark on the women's game. There are going to be trades in the first round of this draft. Whether Minnesota will be able to move from number 7 to number 4 and get Connecticut's pick, I don't know. But I think we're going to see a lot of movement, a lot of interesting things happening. And certainly Minnesota would like Whalen, but she really doesn't fit with their team. She's not what they need. So it's difficult for them to really commit to make that move in a basketball framework. But, of course, from a ticket sales and publicity framework, it's exactly what they need to do.
Meanwhile, over the offseason, the Connecticut Sun continued the policy of working trade deals designed to bring UConn alums back to Connecticut. The WNBA must have had the same thought in mind when they scheduled Phoenix and the aforementioned first draft pick for Connecticut's home opener. Is this a sound strategy?
Yes and no. And going back to what you're saying about Minnesota, I think if Lindsey Whalen, say, were to be in Minnesota, or Asha Jones, who has just been traded to Connecticut, if they turn out to be starters and very good players, then I think, yes, that probably will boost attendance. But if Asha Jones comes to Connecticut and sits on the bench, no one's going to come see somebody play 10 minutes a game. So there's a certain point at which you have to have good players first. This is professional basketball, after all, and you have to win and you have to perform. And if the Connecticut Sun becomes the Husky alumni club and finishes last, it's not going to help them.
It isn't going to finish last if it becomes the Husky alumni club. Come on.
three
championships in a row at the NCAA level.
Well, they're a great program, but just so you know, Tennessee has signed three of the top high school seniors mm-hmm. in the country who will be freshmen in the fall. Those three players are going to make the Lady Vols team to beat for the next 4 years.
Heard it here first. Finally, Clay, the WNBA had a bumpy ride last season with contract problems. A couple of teams folded. This season, the league contends with a month-long break in August because of the Olympics. Are you worried about the health of the league?
Well, yes, Bill, I am. This year, the league is going to get a pass. I think because of the Olympics, the schedule is going to kick into the fall, and they're going to go head-to-head with football during the playoffs. And that could certainly be a problem in TV ratings. However, next year, I think, will really be the key. There will be no excuses. There will be Diana Taurasi. There will be Elena Beard. There will be a lot of things that have happened that should make the league ready to take off. Now, if it doesn't, if 2005 is a bad year, it might be the last year.
Is there more pressure than ever on the WNBA because the WUSA apparently is gone and all but forgotten?
On the one hand, it's bad because it says, oh, professional women's sports can't make it. On the other hand, now, if I'm a sponsor or if I'm a young female athlete, I really only have one option, and that's basketball. So maybe it focuses more on women's basketball and makes the sport stronger.
Clay Callum is the editor of Full Court Press. Clay, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. The good times rolled recently at the World Marbles Championship, at least for the victorious German team. Saxonia 1 were triumphant, beating, among others, an English team, the Handcross Rebels, that failed to benefit from the home side advantage. For nearly three-quarters of a century, the championship has been held in the parking lot beside a pub in Crawley, West Sussex, a site long known as the home of marbles. Hundreds of spectators turned out for the event, which lacked, among other things, an entry from the U.S. An American team scheduled to kneel and shoot failed to show for the competition, blaming what tournament organizer Sam McCarthy Fox called, quote, a collective bad back. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, charity runners, defensible or downright uncharitable. But first, the world's top runners will take part in the 108th Boston Marathon on Monday. Among the elite athletes will be defending champion Robert Cheruiyot and two-time winner Catherine Ndereba, both of whom represent Kenya and that country's tradition of running excellence. A tradition that may be slowing down just a bit. Recently, some of Kenya's top runners have changed citizenship to run for other countries. Sadie Babbitts recently visited a track meet in western Kenya where the issue of athletic defections was on everybody's mind.
At the sound of a whistle, four men strolled to the start line for the 400-meter hurdles. They each dropped to one knee, digging their cleated track shoes into the red dirt, their fingers forming pyramids on the white chalk start line. A hush falls over the small crowd as runners wait for the crack of the gun. The men's 400-meter hurdle is just one of many events at this weekend track meet in Kakamega, a small town perched high in the tropical forests of western Kenya. 10,000-meter runner Daniel Karish is using this meet to test his strengths and find his weaknesses as he makes a bid for Kenya's Olympic team.
I believe if I will train hard, I will actually make it.
But Athens isn't the only thing on his mind. Karish, like so many other Kenyan athletes, is having second thoughts about running for Kenya.
You sweat and you cannot be recognized. It is better you go to another country whereby they will consider you to be a very important person.
Karish says Kenyan government officials don't care about the welfare of their athletes, especially when it comes to their financial well-being. That's why he would have no qualms about changing his citizenship to race for another country. That's exactly what world 3,000-meter steeplechase champion Stephen Chirono did last year. He defected to Qatar, changed his name to Saeed Saif Shaheen, and plans to convert to Islam. Kenya felt the backlash when he went on to win gold for Qatar at the World Championships in Paris last August. David Okeo is the Secretary General for Athletics Kenya, the country's sports governing body. He says it's a shame Shaheen and others have defected because he believes Kenyan athletes are treated fairly.
Like now, let's say if the athletes are in the training camp, we spend money on them. We give them the allowances. They are not there for free. We pay for their free accommodation. We look after their health. All these are being paid by the Kenya government. Their duty is to train and see to it that they go and run and win.
But according to Kenyan runners, past and present, their government doesn't do enough for its running heroes. Qatar, for example, now employs Shaheen in the country's armed forces and has guaranteed him $1,000 a month for life. Okeo says Kenya can't afford to pay runners because there are simply too many of them, so they are considered amateurs.
They're not professional as far as Kenya is concerned. But, again, they run, they earn good money, and government is not taxing that.
Earning good money is relative. It means runners like Daniel Karish must win, and win big at major international events in order to make ends meet. A win at the World Cross Country Championships, for example, nets a runner $60,000. But that money comes from the International Association of Athletics Federations, not Kenya. One of Kenya's top coaches, Joseph Ngure, says it's difficult to win that type of money at a major international event given the growing pool of talented runners. The promise of making money, he says, has forced some of the country's best to put their nationality up for sale.
Kenya is endowed with a great many talents, such that when we are to choose a team to go and represent the country, we only take three people in an event. There's another issue of poverty. If by running for Kenya, the others are not able to earn as much as they could earn elsewhere, then the others are going because they are being offered money in the first place to go.
Wilson Kipketer and Anderson Kiplagat were the first to give up their Kenyan citizenship to race for Denmark in 1997. Dozens of other runners have since joined the defection bandwagon, leaving for Finland, Bahrain, and the U.S. Ngure says he doesn't blame them for leaving.
We have so many athletes, great athletes of the previous regime in the past. They are now very poor. Despite having run for the country, despite having won medal for the country, they are now in the villages. Some of them are being hospitalized. They are not be able to clear from hospital because they are having bills and the government does not give them anything.
Ngure worries countries like Qatar will continue to entice Kenya's top talent to leave if Kenya can't match what other countries are offering. Secretary General David Okeo says the country is trying to keep up with these offers by creating similar incentives.
To retain the athletes in the country, we have to come out with good rewards. People have given quite a number of proposals, including even buying land for them, where they can build their houses or buying houses for them. The government is going to set up also the welfare fund so that they can get something from that fund when they retire from running.
Some of these proposals will surface in Kenya's first-ever sports policy due out later this year. The Kenyan government says it's considering a strategy for paying runners. Meanwhile, Athletics Kenya is pushing for compensation from countries that take Kenyan athletes away and to tighten international rules governing athletic transfers. At the weekend track meet in Kakamega, there is a handful of runners with strong loyalty. But most talk of racing for other countries and the recognition and financial freedom that would come with defection. That's something to consider in Kenya, where half the population lives in poverty. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts in Kakamega, Kenya.
Over the past year or so, 20,000 dedicated runners have trained and prepared successfully enough and finished a marathon fast enough to receive their timing chip and official entry into Monday's Boston Marathon. 1,100 others, many of whom are novices, have received their timing chip through local charities, for which they will raise $7 million and provide many inspirational sound bites for the nightly news. Sounds good, right? Well, maybe not. According to Jonathan Beverly, editor-in-chief of Running Times magazine, he joins me now in the studio. Jonathan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Tom Garrity, the coordinator of the American Liver Foundation's Run for Research, one of the charities to benefit from the Boston Marathon, is also in the studio. Hello, Tom.
Hi, thanks for having us here.
In 2002, at events like the Boston Marathon, American runners raised more than $520 million for charity. But, Jonathan, in September you co-authored an article that called into question the benefits of charity running to the sport of running itself. What inspired the story?
Well, we try to represent runners who see running as part of their identity and who run as an end in itself. Our athletes, the ones who read Running Times, don't run primarily to lose weight or to get fit or to live longer. They run because running is a joy. Running is something that they consider essential to their lives. Charity running, while they applaud the causes that they support, we wonder why running has to enter the equation at all. If there's a need and people have resources to meet that need, what does running have to do with it? In adding running to it, it makes running a labor. It makes running something that you have to get paid to do, something that people would, why would people sponsor you to do it? Would people sponsor you to say, I don't know, play an instrument, learn to play an instrument?
So running is somehow becoming less pure, less something that people do for unencumbered motives.
Exactly.
When this charity stuff is grafted onto it.
As an early 20th century poem we quoted by Sorley, he was heading to World War I, and he's running with his friends, and he compares it to the winds blowing in the trees. He says, does it pause, and do we ask it why? We run without a cause because we love it through the great broad land. I mean, this is what running is to us. That's great that you support that cause, but your running has nothing to do with that.
I see. Still, what's the problem with a relatively small number of runners crossing the finish line in support of a charity instead of because running is part of who they are or because they're pursuing athletic glory or even a personal best time?
There are a couple of issues. One is the intensive media attention that these runners get that distorts the entire image of running. We get very little coverage even at the top level of running, but there's tremendous amount of coverage for the charity aspect. Mm-hmm. Another is Boston is special. Boston's unique because of, you mentioned, the qualifying time. While Boston is certainly welcome to invite charity runners to participate, those who have trained for years, often decades perhaps, to qualify for Boston, to have somebody be able to then get an entry number to Boston, basically buying their way in, that irritates. We applaud the cause, and there is no question that it accomplishes good things, but I also understand those who take offense at that.
Mm-hmm. 230 of Monday's marathoners will run in support of the American Liver Foundation in the hopes of raising more than $1 million this time around. Tom, what does that money do for your organization?
That money is really important to the American Liver Foundation. We have a variety of programs in education, advocacy, and research trying to help people with liver disease. And the $1 million generated by those runners make a lot more possible for the American Liver Foundation, not only locally but nationally. I think that the view that somehow we take something away from the qualified runners who run in the Boston Marathon misses the point a little bit. Our runners, first of all, love to run. A lot of the people on this team have run more than one marathon. They run in small road races. They do triathlons. They compete in endurance events like Reach the Beach, which is a race in New Hampshire that goes 24 hours from in the interior to the coastline. They participate in running, and in fact, they help running flourish, not only in New England, but around. They travel to marathons. For Boston, what they have also chosen to do is raise money for a really worthy cause. And I think if there's a reason the media pays attention to that, is that because it generates a lot of really outstanding stories around the marathon. And if you watch coverage around here locally on Monday, you'll see stories about the elite athletes, and you'll see stories about qualified runners. You'll also see stories about our charity runners are people maybe who are running, such as one runner on our team who has had a liver transplant and mm-hmm. runs the marathon now. I think it's her third or fourth time. It's all part of, I think, the great event that the Boston Marathon is, but I don't think our presence detracts from the qualified runners at all. I think, if anything, we add another new element, and the Boston Athletic Association, I think, should be applauded for wanting to include that in their race.
When you sat down and read the Running Times article, which makes a very clear distinction between elite runners and athletes on the one hand and people running to support a charity on the other, what was your response? Were you angry? Were you upset by it?
My thought was like, you know how if you really liked this band or a restaurant that wasn't popular and then it became really popular and you get kind of upset at the people who have come into your turf?
Nobody goes there. It's too crowded.
Exactly. I just felt like there was that kind of almost irrational resentment of our presence. I think that, you know what, our runners, they train really hard. If you take time out of the equation, they train really hard. They're concerned about improving their performance. They honor the tradition of the Boston Marathon. And they do a lot of the things that the elite runners and qualified runners do. The only thing we don't have is speed. For instance, I was worried today that you might challenge us to a road race to settle this, and I'm going to lose. So,
ironically, though, you will be running on Monday.
Yes, and uh-huh. I've trained really hard. We started a performance running program this year for runners who want to improve their time. And maybe that means actually a slow runner becoming a little less slow. You know, a 4-hour and 30-minute marathoner trying to get down to that magical 4-hour barrier for us.
Again, I mean, I applaud those efforts, and a lot of things you've mentioned are things that we, in our recommendations, we said that charity should do, encourage people to get involved in clubs, to run in other events, to become lifetime runners. As far as the Boston, as far as you're saying that one thing they don't have is speed, I would ask, I mean, do you give an award perhaps to somebody who raises the most money for the year, or is there a special distinction for those who are very good at fundraising?
Sure.
Within your, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I came to your club and joined it this year, and I'm not very good at fundraising, but I said, you know, I'd really like to get that award, and I'm not going to be able to meet the level. You know, perhaps you give it for those who reach, you know, $5,000. I can only raise $3,000, but I can run a sub-3-hour marathon. Can you give me the $5,000 award? Running Boston is an award for being fast.
Right. But let me ask you a question, Jonathan, sure. that occurs to me. Are you surprised when Tom says that a lot of the runners who you would categorizes charity runners, in fact, get better and better and better as they go along and run race after race after race and actually move towards becoming competitive no matter how they began to get involved?
No, I'm not surprised, and I'm happy to hear that. I did do some research and talk to several groups. I think some of the larger groups, your group might be a little different than some of the larger groups who tend to recruit first-time runners, get them in a program, get them through the marathon, and then they say they never hear from 15 to 20% again. That concerns me, and it concerns me some that these groups that are doing that, their final goal is to raise money, and regardless what happens to running, they're unconcerned. It sounds like you are the ideal in this world, is that you are both a runner and you're dedicated to the cause.
And that's a lot of people on our team. That was my reaction reading the article, that I think maybe that the editors weren't aware exactly of what the charity programs might be doing for running. Because if there are tens of thousands of people who enter into running through charity programs every year, and even only 20% of them stick around, that's still a lot of people every year getting into the sport and staying in the sport. And on top of it all, I don't want to ignore this because I'm talking about the running, but we do a lot of good. You know, the Run for Research team has raised over the past 16 years, after this year, more than $8 million for the American Liver Foundation. Mm-hmm. And the Boston Athletic Association's program has raised tens of millions of dollars for a lot of charities.
What's going to happen one day that's going to resolve this whole argument is somebody who's in the marathon strictly to raise money for the Liver Foundation or the Heart Disease Foundation or whatever foundation it might be, and he's going to run away with the thing and finish in 1:48.7.
I'm working on that right now.
I
wouldn't hold your breath, but I'll do what I can.
Tom Garrity is the coordinator for the American Liver Foundation's Run for Research marathon team. Tom, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And Jonathan Beverly is the editor-in-chief of Running Times magazine. Jonathan, thank you for coming in.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with John Feinstein about the late Bruce Edwards, Caddy for Life. But first, our discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA playoffs begin today. Among the interesting first-round matchups are New Jersey against New York, Minnesota versus Denver, San Antonio versus Memphis, but perhaps the most intriguing first-round matchup, Houston and the Lakers. What do you think?
Well, I think you've just demonstrated the problem with the NBA playoffs. All the intriguing matchups are in the Western Conference. yeah, I mean, the Eastern Conference has New York is 4 games under .500 and Boston 10 games under .500, both in the playoffs. There's a real imbalance here. That having been said, I think that the NBA couldn't have asked for a better first-round matchup than Shaquille O'Neal and Yao Ming, who has learned to play against Big Aristotle over the last 2 or 3 games.
Is there a low seed somewhere in that mix of clubs, that crowded mix of teams that you think might surprise folks?
Ordinarily, I would say Houston because of the wild card of Yao Ming and the ability of Steve Francis to take over a game. Problem is they have exactly the wrong first-round matchup. They're playing the Lakers and not the Timberwolves. If the Timberwolves were playing the Houston Rockets, that would be an intriguing matchup. However, the Timberwolves still have to prove they can win a series. And that's the most intriguing thing of all.
Meanwhile, one of the better pre-playoff stories in the NBA had Bob Sura of the 28-54 Atlanta Hawks issuing one of those "I'm sorry if what I did offended anybody" type apologies. What was that all about?
Well, apparently it offended the NBA because they took away a phony triple-double that he had conspired to do. He intentionally missed a layup so he could get a rebound and get himself a triple-double. The NBA got upset, took it away. I think Bob Sura has been a little bit of a loose cannon ever since he was at Florida State. This doesn't surprise me in the least. He seems to have reacted pretty well. And what the heck? He plays for Atlanta, where only 3 people go to the games anyway.
The Hawks have been making news for all the wrong reasons lately. At family night on Monday, the public address guy queued up a rap song full of obscenities. Hey, kids, listen to this. Where do you suppose that guy's employed these days?
What will we tell the children? And the scary thing, of course, is that every kid in the audience knew exactly what was coming.
Was singing
because
along.
They all own the record.
Of course,
exactly.
Of course. The NHL playoffs are temporarily diverting attention from the league's looming labor woes, Charlie. Which first-round series has provided adequate diversion for you?
Well, there certainly was the geopolitical moment in the Montreal-Boston series where the Montreal fans booed the American National Anthem. The Boston fans on Thursday night responded, I think, with a great deal of class by cheering the Canadian National Anthem, which was about all that the Boston fans had to cheer Thursday night because Montreal came in and smacked them around 5-1. I was a little bit disappointed, actually, that my Nashville Predators, with my friend Jordan Tattoo, first Inuit drafted in the NHL, lost a pivotal Game 5 to the Red Wings. I think if they had managed to go up to Detroit and steal one and come back to the Opryland Ice Arena with a chance to close it out, it would have been extremely interesting. I think Detroit will close them out now. I think all the teams that are ahead right now will win, although I would not want to be the Boston Bruins going back to Montreal to win the game.
Larry Ellison, a San Francisco Giants fan partial to kayaking, retrieved Barry Bonds' home runs number 660 and 661, the home runs with which Bonds first tied and then surpassed Willie Mays on the all-time home run list. Mr. Ellison was paddling around in McCovey Cove at the time, and he didn't even have a net. I wouldn't rank his achievement up there with Bonds exactly, but not bad, huh? 2 in a row at that level?
Well, I wouldn't even rank it up there with the long escaped scene from Last of the Mohicans, kayak-wise. But this is the way we produce sports celebrities today. We build ballparks by the ocean. I would point out that it's very hard to do this at Wrigley Field, to retrieve balls with kayaks.
Absolutely. Mr. Ellison gave number 660 right back to Barry Bonds, and he says home run ball number 661 will not show up on eBay. What kind of American is this guy?
He is, however, going to sell the kayak for $350,000. actually, he could use a little bit of extra income because apparently his cell phone fell in the cove and isn't working real well.
On Thursday, a federal court ruled that the city of Augusta illegally restricted a National Council of Women's Organizations protest during last year's Masters Golf Tournament. Is this a milestone in the freedom of political expression? Should we all be huzzaing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very good decision, and I agree with it. I would point out, however, that the city of Augusta got what it wanted, which was to move the protest illegally away from the site at the time that the event was going on. It's a win for Martha Burke, who hasn't had many lately.
I don't know whether you've checked your email today, Charlie, but when you do, you may
find... I did, because people needed money, and I sent them some.
And I hope that one of the people on that list was the Olympics in Athens. Will you explain your contribution?
The latest spam scam. People are emailing a request for help to pay for the blood testing of the athletes at the Summer Olympics. I would have found it more believable if they'd solicited money to pay for, like, a roof on the swimming facility.
Actually, I understand that what those running the Olympic Games really need right now is a dependable torch. When it goes out, do they have to go all the way back to the beginning and start running again?
I hope not, but I think we should all, you know, go out in our backyards and cut up a goat and let some doves loose, because I don't think Zeus is real fond of the idea of having the Olympics in Athens anymore. I think Zeus was counting on another trip to Barcelona.
A group of folks who cheered on a particular German soccer team until that team went out of business recently now will root for any team you like for a price, and they come pretty cheap.
Yes, they're renting themselves out to other clubs for beer and sausages, which is interesting because there's another group of fans who are following this first group around renting themselves out as air fresheners. Boom.
Finally, Charlie, as you know, I'm still in mourning for the WUSA, but I am comforted that at least the women who played in that league never had it quite as bad as the guys playing for Soccer Club Quindío in Bogotá.
They're not feeding them. They're not feeding them, and I think there's no question that the people who play for Quindío, it's time to go for Germany and see what the rate of exchange is.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On April 8th, the first day of this year's Masters Golf Tournament, Bruce Edwards died. The longtime caddy and friend of Tom Watson, Edwards had been suffering with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. In the introduction to his most recent book, Caddy for Life, John Feinstein speaks of Bruce Edwards and his, quote, passionate desire to caddy. That's a phrase that may initially have struck even Feinstein, who tends to enjoy golf and the company of golfers, as somewhat peculiar. But once he'd come to know Bruce Edwards well, the passionate desire to caddy began to seem reasonable enough, and when he learned that Edwards had been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, Feinstein discovered a compulsion to tell the popular caddy's story. John Feinstein joins me now from his home in Maryland. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Good to talk to you again.
When Bruce Edwards told you that he was thinking about a book, but only wanted to do it if you would be his partner, what was your first reaction?
Well, to be honest, Bill, my first reaction was, oh, God, no, please don't say that, because I was flattered. Bruce and I had been friends for 22 years, dating back to my days at the Washington Post when I first met him in 1981. And a part of me said, I want to do this because he's my friend, but a bigger part of me said, oh, God, I don't want to watch a friend die. But as I stood there talking to him, we were on the veranda at Augusta last year, I realized that if he is my friend, I had to do the book. And I also thought there was a compelling story to be told. His relationship with Tom Watson over 30 years, the changes in golf and caddying in the tour over that period of time, and then what he was facing at that moment, having been diagnosed with ALS in January. So in about a 60-second period, I went from, I can't possibly do this, to, I really should do this.
The relationship between Bruce Edwards and Tom Watson, for whom Edwards caddied for about a quarter of a century, was extraordinary. Were these guys just wonderfully well-suited to be each other's friends?
I think that's exactly right. They meshed almost from the first day they met, July 14, 1973, in St. Louis, when Bruce was a 19-year-old kid just out of high school who had told his parents he was going to take 1 year off to caddy before he went to college. His parents were both graduates of Penn, so they were horrified at the thought of one of their children not going to college. And Tom was 24, second year on tour, graduate of Stanford. And Bruce, as it worked back in those days, walked up to him in the parking lot and said, "I'm Bruce Edwards. Do you need a caddy this week?" And Watson said, "Yes, we'll try it for a week." And 30 years later, they were still trying it. But they each found the other to be fun to be with. Their senses of humor were similar. And Tom, from the beginning, saw Bruce as a peer. And he treated him that way. Now, on the golf course, Bruce understood clearly who the boss was. But he also knew that Tom wanted him to talk back to him if he thought that was the best thing for Tom's game. And a lot of players will not allow or do not want their caddies to do that. Tom Watson always did.
One of the things that surprised me when I first learned about Bruce Edwards was that he had no health insurance. Even golfers who finish low on the tour's money list make hundreds of thousands of dollars and sometimes a lot more. Why don't they make sure that their caddies are covered?
That's a very good question, and it's one that's being discussed on the tour right now. And I would be very surprised if within the next year the PGA Tour does not come out with some kind of health plan for caddies after they've been vested, after 5 years, whatever it might be. But again, caddying was an evolving profession when Bruce came into it. In the 1960s, when Bruce first started caddying as a kid at his parents' club in Wethersfield, Connecticut, there were very few traveling tour caddies. In the 70s, Bruce was in the first generation that really professionalized caddying. But even into the 1990s, Bill, caddies were still looked down on by a lot of people. They weren't allowed in the clubhouse. You know, their player would have to take the bag at the clubhouse door because caddies weren't supposed to go inside. And it's really been a long, hard battle for both players and caddies to convince the people who run golf that the caddies play an important role in the game and they're important to their players and that they are very professional, good people, because that's what they are.
John, when the word that Bruce Edwards had ALS became public, Edwards found himself in a very strange position regarding his job. Over the years, he'd often been asked about Tom Watson's game, of course. He was his caddy. But all of a sudden, Tom Watson was being asked about his caddy. How well did the two of them handle that kind of reversal in roles?
They handled it superbly, with great grace and dignity and humor. And both of them understood that to do what they wanted to do, which was raise awareness about ALS, help with fundraising for ALS, make a mark while Bruce was still alive, that they did have to reverse those roles, that Tom did have to talk about Bruce and did have to talk about ALS, and Bruce had to talk about himself. Bruce was much more comfortable being the guy behind the guy. And now suddenly he was, as you said, thrust into the spotlight, and he was the guy. At the U.S. Open last year in Chicago, when Tom shot that amazing 65 in the first round and became the oldest man in history to ever lead a U.S. Open, naturally, many of the writers wanted to talk about Bruce because the day was Tom and Bruce. It wasn't just Tom. Mm-hmm. And Bruce really initially didn't want to go out and talk to the media. For one thing, after 5 hours carrying the bag, he was exhausted. And when he was tired at that point, it was difficult for him to speak. But the other thing was he thought, Tom shot the 65, not me. Well, Tom was, of course, in talking to the media, and it was kind of a remarkable story. A fellow named Steve Malchow, who is the sports information director at the University of Wisconsin, who is an insulin-dependent diabetic, was working as a PR volunteer at the Open. And he walked into the locker room, and he said to Bruce, "I understand why you don't want to talk. You're exhausted. You think it's about Tom. But I watch Scott Verplank play all the time." Verplank was paired with Bruce and Tom that day. "He's an insulin-dependent diabetic like me, and I take inspiration from his ability to play and win golf tournaments. I know that ALS is much worse. From what I've heard about it, many people, when they're diagnosed, stop living. You haven't stopped living. You're still doing what you do. You're still being who you are. I can't imagine that isn't inspirational to people. And if you just go out and talk for a few minutes, I think a lot of people will be grateful." And Bruce said, "Okay," and he walked out there. And Steve Malchow told me later, he's been in the PR business for 30 years, when Bruce started talking about Tom and their friendship and what the day meant to him and how he believed that Tom had done this for him, he said he saw reporters, you know, TV guys, radio guys, print guys, crying. And that in all his years in PR, he'd never seen anything quite like that. And I was there that day, Bill, and I can tell you I've never seen anything like that either.
Bruce Edwards died back on April 8th. Was he able to tell you in the weeks and months before his death how he felt about your effort to tell his story? Because he had, in fact, you know, tabbed you. You were the guy. Otherwise, right, there wouldn't have been a book.
No, he did. I obviously sent him an advanced copy of the manuscript, not only so he could read it, but so he could fact check me. He was the best fact checker I've ever had. but I met my goal, Bill, late in March, a couple weeks before publication, when I was able to actually put the book, you know, have the book reach Bruce, the actual book. And he was still sending emails until a couple days before he died. He couldn't talk, but he was able to send emails, and he had written me. We wrote almost every day back and forth to each other. He was trash-talking me about the UConn-Duke game right up to the very end. But he did tell me how he felt. And, you know, there are moments when you lose a friend, especially someone you spent this kind of time with, when you cry, obviously. And my last really good cry came the day of the funeral on Monday in Ponte Vedra. We all went to the house afterwards, and Bruce's wife, Marcia, handed me a copy of the book that Bruce had signed to me before he died. And when I read the inscription, needless to say, I had a nice long cry in the car by myself that evening.
John Feinstein is the author of Caddy for Life, The Bruce Edwards Story, published by Little Brown. He joined me from his home in Maryland. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. I enjoyed it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Barati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or learn more about John Feinstein's book, Caddy for Life, The Bruce Edwards Story, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from marathoner and American Liver Foundation coordinator Tom Garrity, who expresses relief that his point-counterpoint foil, Jonathan Beverly, does not have the voice of Olivier.
I was just worried you were going to have a rich, sonorous voice and it was going to sound like you were debating a Muppet.
Well, no one wants to sound like Scooter or Gonzo, but that Sam the Eagle had quite a set of pipes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.